I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, a show for curious cooks and eaters. About 15 years ago, I was invited to a benefit event for the Southern Foodways Alliance. They're a great organization that studies the evolving food culture of the American South. Anyway, the thing was like a three-day-long affair with all these great chefs, right? And I remember meeting this young chef there. He made this cool little dish. I guess he would have called what he was making back then molecular gastronomy, because he took beans and pepper jelly and made them into a shape that beans and pepper jelly have never been in before. But his food was so different than what everyone else was making that weekend. And I appreciated it. And I remember talking with him one night by a fireplace after everyone else had gone to bed. And he was quiet and thoughtful. And I wondered a little bit if he was maybe nervous to be there, right? Because he was a lot younger than the other chefs. And these were all people who were talked about not just as stars of Southern cooking, but literally people who had, quote, saved their cities, or, you know, who were inspiring a new generation of Southern chefs. And here was this young guy who was doing this like weird stuff, and I wondered if he felt like he belonged. And then I wondered a little if he was maybe still finding his voice and doing the things that lots of young artists do, taking risks and really trying to find the edges of what's good, you know? Well, that young chef's name is Sean Brock. And if he walked into that kind of event today, he would be the one that you'd say had inspired a whole generation of Southern chefs. He's won every James Beard Award known to man, and for years he was everywhere, at every chef event, at every party, armed with bourbon and a huge laugh. And through his restaurants, most famously Husk, the many TV shows and documentaries made about him, and his cookbooks, Heritage and his new one called South, he has shown himself to be a passionate student of Southern traditions and heirloom ingredients, and both very new and very old techniques. He worked and he partied harder than anyone, but after more than a decade of living life all the way to the edge, it almost killed him. Eventually, he got sober. He left his restaurants, and a few weeks ago, I got to catch up with him for a long conversation. Of course, we talked about Southern food, what it means, its diversity, but also how parenthood and getting better refocused him while he's getting ready to get back into the restaurant world. I am so proud to see who that young chef I met all those years ago became and who he's still becoming. Sean Brock, it's great to have you here, my friend.
Oh, great to be here. Great to see you.
I'm happy to see you. Congratulations on being a new dad.
Thank you.
We're going to get into that later. But I first want to talk to you about, you know, I got to see you randomly a couple months ago in LA when you were doing a fried chicken pop-up in Los Angeles. First of all, tell us about the fried chicken you were making that day.
Well, fried chicken to me is something that I'll always be amazed by, and something that I'll always be studying and trying to perfect. Mm. It's also really fun to look at it regionally.
Yeah.
And the fried chicken that I was making that day comes from North Carolina and mostly gas stations. I think a lot of the best food comes from rural gas stations in the South. That's my infatuation right now. I'm focusing on that because I grew up with that.
Yeah.
Because you have these old grandmothers back there who've been making biscuits at this gas station for 40 years, every right. single day.
When it was like actually the town store. It was basically the general store, right? It's where everyone had to come.
Yeah, and there was one right near my house growing up. So I was drawn to this style of fried chicken, and it's called dipped chicken, D-I-P-P-E-D. Mm-hmm. And it's like a cross between buffalo chicken and Nashville hot chicken.
That's so good.
That's like perfect.
Like, I did get to taste it and it was awesome, but even if I hadn't, just describing something that way. But so, how'd you make it?
I'm trying to remember. So, so this was like a pretty simple batter, but the complexity comes in the sauce. And it's a cooked sauce. Mm-hmm. you put hot sauce and Worcestershire and sorghum and then a million secret umami ingredients and then vinegar and just cooked it until it tasted insane.
Yeah.
And then you just dip the chicken in it and it's just amazing.
Yeah. You also had this crazy technique that I'd never seen before where you fried the chicken, it was already, and then you rewarmed it.
Oh, yeah. It's a double dip. Yeah. So basically inspired by Nashville Hot Chicken, where you take chicken from the fryer and then you take some of the grease from the fryer and mix it with spices and then coat the chicken in that. I did something similar. We fried the chicken and then we kind of woke it back up in some chicken fat before we dipped it in the sauce. It would be amazing to have a fryer full of chicken fat.
I like you woke it back up in chicken fat. Okay, so, I mean, that's amazing. It was delicious. Like you said, it was, you know, it was inspired by gas station fried chicken that you'd seen in North Carolina. And, you know, when I first met you, way back in
I remember when we first met.
In our 20s. Mm-hmm. And you were a chef at the time, and you were making high-flying things like perfect pucks of black-eyed pea puree filled with a liquid pepper jelly center. And, you know, we're a lot older now. And it seems like your trajectory as a chef has been more and more to kind of go back home. To go back to the food your grandmother cooked you in the coal country of West Virginia. I remember, in fact, a gala event you did where you brought in your mom to
that
help you come.
That was one of my fondest memories of my entire life.
So let's get back to that. Like, let's, from where do you start? How did you get into cooking?
Well, I grew up in a very rural part of the South, in the southern Appalachian part of Virginia. And when you're that far back in the mountains, you cook pretty much all day. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, and then in between, you're preserving and prepping. And so the kitchen is just a constant hub of activity. And so I grew up in the kitchen. You walk into my grandmother's front door and you walk into the kitchen.
Yeah.
And most people never made it past the kitchen. Like we were never in the living room. We never ate in the dining room. We always ate in the kitchen. And so food just was part of my life at a very young age. And she had an enormous garden, and getting to spend time there and tasting food while it's still alive and vibrant was something that I think I became hooked on and used to at a very young age. Mm. And then I discovered Justin Wilson and Julia Child and Jacques Pepin and Yan Can Cook. And then Emeril Lagasse, the Food Network, came out.
Yeah.
And I realized that I could do it as a profession.
Yeah.
And I was hooked.
And that was it. And then you went to culinary school in Charleston, South Carolina. So coming from this background that was very much about the garden, very much about the traditional ways of cooking, why'd you get so into these super modern futuristic techniques?
I've been so curious my entire life, and I remain so curious. I think that's one of the things that really fuels me, is just wondering why and how. And I think another thing, really important factor, is I love to laugh. And some of that stuff makes you laugh, you know? And I think when you can add that emotion to comforting someone with food, that's the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Like I mean, that chicken in L.A., like you eat it, we just started laughing. It was so ridiculous.
I totally remember you gave it to me in a cup. It was almost like an ice cream cone. Yeah. So it just started, it was hot. So it was like eating out of the cup like an ice cream cone. And we just started giggling because
yeah.
It was so good.
Yeah. And that food, I think modernist food did that for me. And it scratched that itch. And that's when we were all discovering Ferran Adrià.
Mm-hmm.
And
chef
this
in Spain at El Bulli.
Yes, and this is pre-Instagram, pre-having the ability to look on your phone for pictures of people's meals from across the world. So you had to dig to find those techniques and those ingredients and those stories and those pictures. And yeah, I became obsessed.
Yeah, and there was so much of that cooking that was about, you know, people thought of it as being a cooking of you know, technique and showing off, but really so much of it was about, like you said, making people laugh, like the surprise. Like, what is this hockey puck?
Yeah.
And you cut into it, and it's like, come on, that's black eyed peas and red pepper jelly. Like, that's ridiculous.
Man, making that was a nightmare. That was really, I was up till like 4 a.m. making all those silly pucks.
And then now, you know, again, fast forward a bunch of years, and now you're really known through your books and, you know, through many magazine profiles and, you know, TV shows and documentaries made about you. You're really known as someone who is about bringing back and preserving old Southern ingredients and traditions. When did that become a part of what you do?
When I moved to Charleston to go to school and started working in professional kitchens, I would often speak about the food of my childhood and the food of my family, mm-hmm. and no one had ever heard of any of it. Mm. I was speaking a foreign language. Mm. No one had ever had a pawpaw. You know, no one had ever experienced, you know, these old Appalachian traditions. No one had ever had sour corn. And I assumed that everybody knew about this stuff and that everybody ate it. And so that helped me realize how special and unique the food ways of that region were, which then became a source of pride. And so every time I would go home to see my family, I would just try and absorb as much of their cooking and wisdom and seeds and jars as possible. I would have this plan when I would go to my grandmother's house, because she would only let me leave with 4 or 5 jars each time.
There was a limit.
Because I would have just taken everything. And so I'm like, this time I want 2 sour corns and 2 mixed pickles. Next time I want 2 pickles, you know, and so it was something that brought me closer to my grandmother, brought me closer to my family. And looking back now, those were the seeds that grew into where I am today.
Yeah. Do you think it was also a way of your grandmother making you visit home more often?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, what an amazing experience as a child, seeing the old-fashioned way of growing food, cooking food, and preserving food, and sharing food.
Yeah.
We have to keep that alive. We have to keep doing that. We have to.
And we'll be back with more with Chef Sean Brock.
If you break the South off of the United States, make it its own country, put it beside continental Europe, they're pretty much the same size. And so if we're considering that country of the South one cuisine, we've got it all wrong. We don't consider continental Europe one cuisine.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending this episode with the chef, Sean Brock. He's been called a savior of Southern food, and while he would never call himself that, he is part of a community that definitely earns that title, with people like the heirloom grain expert Glenn Roberts, restaurateur Martha Lou Gadsden, pitmaster Rodney Scott, and historian David Shields. And we start the next part of our conversation talking about one of Sean's heroes. It seems like you have sort of gotten yourself involved in, or in some ways helped create, a community that is about bringing back and preserving Southern ingredients and traditions. And you also, you work with historians like David Shields, and you work with...
What a superhero.
Tell us about him.
David Shields is a professor who I believe is one of the most brilliant human beings on the face of the planet, and he has many quirky hobbies, and one of them happens to be food. And he just has this ability to research things and have access to agricultural journals and things that aren't on Google. That I can be curious about something, wondering what the most popular dish in the hotels of 1850 were throughout America. And the next day I get an email with all of them. I mean, that's amazing. And he's just been such a huge part of my development and just such an amazing source of knowledge. Oh, we just geek out so much. It's amazing.
Can I tell you, like, when I was in college, before we had Google, my friends and I had this running joke of your own amazing heaven, which we all meant like, oh, when we all die, we get to like go to the heaven that like most fits who we are. Mm-hmm. And my own amazing heaven was a machine I could go up to and ask any question and get the answer to. Like, what was I wearing, you know, on my fourth birthday, you know, before I got ready for a birthday party? And like the machine would spit it out. But like David Shields is like your own amazing heaven.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And he has some amazing books where he's compiled a lot of this research. And I refer back to them all the time.
Incredible.
One is called The Culinarians, and it's documenting the work of American chefs from around 1700 to like 1930, which is, I definitely realize what a nerd I am saying that.
Okay, so speaking of books, I was looking at this a couple years ago and came across a really interesting statistic, I guess you could call it. And that is, there was a span of about 6 or 7 years. So the James Beard Awards, of which you've won many, like everyone there is to give. But the James Beard Awards, you know, there's a category for Best American Cookbook. And again, for a span of 6 or 7 years, like 16 of the 19 finalists
were Southern.
Were all books on Southern food.
Yeah.
And you just came out with a new book called South. And I think, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems to me that what drives you is this sense that there is still so much misunderstanding or underappreciation of what Southern food is.
And there's so much to explore and so much to discover that I could write a new book each year and it would be just pages and pages of new stuff that I'm learning each year.
Like what?
Well, this book, South, I wanted to focus on the diversity within each region. And I refer to that as micro regions. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the South, if you break the South off of the United States, make it its own country, put it beside continental Europe, they're pretty much the same size. Hmm. And so if we're considering that country of the South one cuisine, we've got it all wrong.
Right.
We don't consider continental Europe one cuisine.
Right.
So that's a lifetime of studying and discovering and being curious and playing.
And you had mentioned earlier with the fried chicken, that style of dipped fried chicken was specific to, you know, the gas stations of North Carolina. What are other dishes? Well, actually, let's get back to fried chicken because I can always talk about more fried chicken. What are other versions of fried chicken that you love? And what are other dishes that change through the region?
I was just in New Orleans and got to eat Willie Mae's again. Mm. And it's a place in New Orleans called Willie Mae's Scotch House. And it's a batter. It's like a wet batter. It's very similar to Gus's fried chicken in Memphis. That one, I still haven't figured out how to do that properly. It's way harder than it looks. That one I'm intrigued by. To me, fried chicken, goodness gracious, we could just talk about this for hours. But if I were to say what my favorite style is I like a really thin crust, almost transparent, so we still see the chicken skin. Mm. And I actually prefer it fried in a skillet. And so that's rarely done in restaurants. So if you can find a restaurant that's skillet frying fried chicken, number one, they're crazy. They're probably miserable. But that's a restaurant that cares. Like that's my favorite.
Yeah. Is there a regional aspect to that? Are there parts of the South where that's more prevalent?
You know, I think you only see it in the homes of grandmothers, and you know, you just see it on the stove right beside the country crock tub full of lard and bacon fat. Mm. As far as regionality goes, that's, I think, when you start to get into what goes in the breader. Like, for instance, my family, when we're frying chicken, there's usually cornmeal in the breader because corn grew better than wheat in Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those little tiny things. It's not only just what type of flour it is or if it's cornmeal and flour, if it's just cornmeal, but it's also the spice profiles.
Mm.
And yeah, I don't want to eat some fried chicken. Dang.
So, and speaking of corn, you write about cornbread in your new book, South, and how that is also a marker of regionality.
Well, when I opened Husk, I knew we had to have insane cornbread. And I knew we had to make it to order in a cast iron skillet, you know, with a wood fire. And then we opened three more Husk in three different cities in three different regions. And so I knew that they had to be different and speak to that area. Because it's not only ingredients that show up that are particular to that region and that culture, but it's the flavors that people crave there. And an example would be where I'm from. There was a huge German population, lots of German immigrants who were sauerkrauting, if that's a word, sauerkrauting everything. So that's how sour corn came to be.
Oh, right on.
And sour beans and all these things.
Because and that's just like, well, sauerkraut, you would cut up the cabbage, you salt it, and then you just let the salt bring out the water from the cabbage that creates its own brine, and then it pickles in that brine. So you mean like that, just doing that to other...
Everything. And so you're born into that, and sour corn is always at the table in different sour flavors. And it becomes part of your DNA. It becomes the thing that you crave, the thing that you associate with home. And so when I'm thinking about Appalachian cornbread, I want to make it a little bit sour. So I'll do the same thing to the cornbread batter. I'll let it sit for a couple of days, just out at room temperature. Or I'll fold in some sour corn.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the low country, if I think about eating cornbread in the low country from a historical standpoint, each meal, rice was eaten, and so there's always leftover rice, and that leftover rice gets folded in to the cornbread.
Mm.
And that flavor, like cornbread with rice in it, would only exist there. You would never, I don't think it's ever been done anywhere in Appalachia. Like if you go up into the Smoky Mountains, where Alan Denton is, you're eating some cracklins in the cornbread. If you go to...
Alan Benton, the great ham maker and bacon curer.
The cure master. He's the Jedi master of curing. So I think once you get into being curious about that, then as you start traveling throughout the South, start paying attention to what's in the cornbread. And so I think you'll also find sugar making its way into the batter.
Wait, this is a real thing?
Well, like...
Because I was always told only Yankees put sugar in their cornbread.
Well, it's definitely a source of great debate. And I used to be so hell-bent on no sugar, no sugar, no sugar, because that's what my family did. And that turned out to cause way many more fights than it was worth. So I just let people put sugar in cornbread now.
But okay, so let's go back to this thing that we just talked about a moment ago, where, you know, incredibly popular Southern cookbooks were all over the place. Southern food really, I think, became, this is sort of a funny thing, but I think you'll get when I say it, really kind of became America's national regional food, right?
Well, what else is there?
I'm going to have to go in the back because you know, my friends in Michigan will be pretty upset with me. But like, you know, but it became this thing where it's like so much of what we think of as being Southern food is also like nationally or outside the South, we just consider comfort food, right?
It's like soul food. It's the comfort soul food.
Yeah, and it seems that like on some level too, the more popular Southern food got, it also meant that its stereotypes became more solidified. And the thing you're talking about, that regionality, is kind of lost a little bit in the bigger picture consciousness, right? And, you know, we think of shrimp and grits as just being quote unquote a Southern dish and not specific to the low country or to the coast. And in your book, you it seems like you encourage that a little bit, and at least in terms of people's cooking in their home, there's a, you have a flavor matrix of shrimp and grits, and you know how you might interpret that dish across the different regions. Like in Appalachia, you write you would make it with ramps and morels. So today, if you're developing a dish conceptually, like what makes it Southern to you? Are there line? Is there a checklist that has to fill, or are there like lines you won't cross?
So when I founded Husk, I had to answer all those questions, and it led me to believe that cuisines are shaped by just a few factors. The cultural influences from the immigrants that came to that region, the plants, the ingredients that they brought, the flavors that they brought, and also the ingredients that thrive there, that grow best there.
Mm-hmm.
And then geography. So if you're closer to the coast, or if you're in a more rural part of the mountains. And so if that's kind of the formula, so wherever you go, look for those things, think about those things. And it can be translated easily into the art of country ham or barbecue. You know, barbecue, you can know where you are based on the wood that's used. In Tennessee, hickory is everywhere. And so that's the most plentiful tree, so that's the flavor of the barbecue. In South Carolina, it's white oak. And you can start to pick apart these traditions and understand them. It's being curious about how it naturally came to be. There's no real creativity involved. It's more like this naturally happens because of these factors, and that's why it belongs there. And so if you're trying to tell the story of a place, I think those factors have to be part of the narrative.
Yeah. But in your food too, like I was looking at one of the recipes in the book, and there is something you call West African barbecue sauce. And, you know, there is no such thing in the world called West African barbecue sauce until you came up with it. But in it, there is reference to trips you made to Senegal, for instance, to see what a lot of the roots of Southern cuisine were, you know, because they came from the enslaved Africans who were brought here from West Africa. So when you say there's no creativity involved, what's that?
I think that's secondary. I think the creativity, so I have a theory that I always look to when I'm creating something, and it's called the pie theory. P-I-E. So P stands for products. That's the first thing you have to gather. The products that thrive there, belong there, speak of that culture. The I stands for ideas. That's where you can start to be creative and kind of make it your own if you want. And then E being the execution from a professional chef standpoint. What can I actually produce for 200 people a night?
not skillet frying chicken.
Yeah, I can dream up anything, but just to be able to execute it properly is a completely different story. But if you start adding creativity in, I think that's where you start to introduce humor, and you can create newer emotions. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
But also, I think creativity keeps people interested, keeps their attention. Because if you just keep making the same bowl of shrimp and grits, people are probably going to get tired of it and move on to the next thing that piques their interest. But if you can be creative and make it a little more interesting each time, then you keep the narrative alive by holding their attention.
But that's so interesting, because there's also this idea that so much of Southern food is about tradition. It's supposed to be about the way my grandma made it, the way Meemaw made it. You know, like that's the way, that's the right way.
So my approach now is something that I've been thinking a lot about and really trying to move towards as a professional chef. And that is, how do you keep those traditions alive without being too creative, but still improving upon it. And so that's why we built a research and development kitchen. So we can take a dish, let's just say my mom's chicken and dumplings. Mm-hmm. If we want to make that, then we can break apart the individual components and then look at each component and say, how can we make more intense versions to season that particular thing? Mm. Something sweet, something salty, something sour, something bitter, something spicy, something with tons of umami. And so you're improving it, but it's still recognizable. Mm. The story's still there. It still is what it is. But we're using insane scientific equipment and modern technology to improve it.
Yeah. Okay, so you've mentioned Husk a few times. That was your group of restaurants, also McCrady's and others. And you're actually not in a restaurant right now. And
it's been pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, actually, I want to get to that because that's really interesting. And you are at work building your new restaurant, but it sounds like it's more than just a restaurant. You just mentioned this research and development kitchen. This is going to be a totally new project for you, a big project. First, tell us about it a little bit.
So I wanted to completely start over. I wanted to forget everything that I've ever learned, everything that I've ever known, anything I've ever done, and just completely start fresh with a blank piece of paper. And that's exactly what I did. And I started writing down all the things that were important to me in a restaurant. And I love simple soul food, comfort food, as much as I love really modern tasting menus. Mm-hmm. Equally, I love them equally, and I always have. That's why McCrady's existed and Husk existed. McCrady's was kind of allowed me to be, to have a ton of fun and be creative and think in a modern sense and use modern techniques and more artistic plating, while Husk helped me try and contribute to those traditions. And so mm-hmm. the building will have two restaurants, one downstairs that will be casual comfort food, one upstairs will be much smaller and tasting menu only. There's a bar that will be doing some really interesting things that will echo what the kitchen's doing. There's a research and development kitchen. And then there's a podcast studio. And then there's, I'm building like a learning center, like a classroom, a library. And then we're building a little wellness mindfulness center for the team. It's like a compound. We're created.
Compound has like weird cult connotations. Yeah. You probably don't want to call it that, but like, a center sounds nice.
Oh, a center.
Sean Brock's new cookbook is called South, and we'll be back with more from Sean.
So when I went to a treatment center in Arizona, I focused heavily on workaholism. And it is dangerous. I mean, you can literally work yourself to death.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. And we're spending this episode with the chef Sean Brock. Now, he mostly made his name in Charleston, South Carolina, but last year he moved to Nashville. He had a restaurant there already. It was a branch of his place Husk, and was traveling between the two cities for a few years, but at some point, he realized Nashville was really home. It's closer to the Appalachian Mountains, where he grew up, and eventually he realized it's where he wanted to settle down and make some big life changes. He left his restaurants. At the time, it was a shock to the restaurant world. Like, how could this guy not have a restaurant? And while people clamored to eat his food, the fact is we might have not just lost his work, we might have lost him. Because life in the restaurant world, combined with his addictions and a rare autoimmune disease that nearly left him blind, was killing him. Until he focused on his sobriety and his health, and recently on his new young family. So in the last part of our interview, Sean talked about the new restaurant he's working to open and mentioned that it was going to include a wellness center. But okay, I love that you bring up the wellness part of it and the mindfulness part of it. So there's a famous story of how, actually your first chef job, when you were first hired to run a restaurant kitchen, you kind of had a rough opening. I think it was something like you had a 30-course tasting menu and 250 people signed up, and it was such a disaster. You only served like 50 people that night or something like that. I can see you twitching right now when I'm mentioning I'm sorry about that. But anyway, the long and the short of it is you made a declaration that you were not going to take a single day off from that job until you turned the ship around and got good reviews. And so for 10 months, you did not take a day off. You slept in the restaurant. And, you know, it's funny because people tell that story like, oh my God, Sean, he's a beast. Like, that guy is like a monster. He's a chef's chef. You know, he's a real, you know, dedicated guy. But I also think the line between incredible work ethic and workaholism is super thin. You're opening this huge new restaurant project, multifaceted project. You're a new father. You have a family. How do you think you'll be able to balance your work and family life?
So when I went to a treatment center in Arizona, I focused heavily on workaholism. And I studied workaholism, and I spoke with lots of really intelligent psychologist about workaholism, and it is dangerous. I mean, you can literally work yourself to death. And I almost did that. I ended up putting my body through obviously my fault for being a workaholic, but just putting my nervous system and my body through so much that I ended up with an autoimmune disease, which I believe is probably the universe's only way to get me to slow down and just kind of smack me in the face. That's what happens. That's what happens. None of us are superheroes. None of us are untouchable. You know, we're human beings built a certain way, wired a certain way, and we're only capable of so much. And I learned that the hard way. And moving forward, I have to keep that in mind every day. Every decision that I make, I have to ask, is this workaholism or is this an actual opportunity to contribute to something I love? But then it gets complex because, it is a contribution to something I love. And then there are seven more things that are also contributions. And I refer to it as the circle of competence. And it's just like cooking. It's like the pie theory. You have to know what you're capable of. And you have to know what you're mentally and physically capable of doing. And the balance is, what can I achieve while staying happy and healthy? Why would I want to achieve more than that? You know, these are the questions that I have to ask myself every time I make a decision. When I'm, you know, approached about opening a new restaurant here, a new restaurant there, any opportunity.
Yeah. It's hard, right? Because I think that's a great formulation. At what point does my work make me happy and healthy and I feel like I'm achieving? At what point does it cross that line into being like, no, it's something else now? But like, we're also in a society, right, where every external marker, every accolade, every external marker of success is about what you produce and is about your work. And I've been thinking about this a lot lately because I've been working with a chef on their book. I won't name them, but they talk about this a little bit in their book, and they have this really, 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 to me, mind-blowing statement on this, which I'd never thought about, which is, for every other addiction, when you hit rock bottom, you know it. In workaholism, when you hit rock bottom, it means you're at the top of your profession.
You're rewarded for it.
You're rewarded for it. As you're getting into opening this thing, do you think it's possible to achieve what you want to achieve? Like, can you be a chef at the level you're accustomed to being without that kind of dangerous stress?
So here's what I believe, and this is my current theory, and this is what's guiding the ship right now. I've been reading a lot from this psychologist named Alfred Adler, who was around in the Carl Jung days and the Freud days. They were kind of a trio. And his work is so simple that most people don't pay attention to it. And it's helped me realize that life really is very, very simple. He says, the thing that stuck with me the most is success or worth. What that means, all that means, if you get right down to it, is finding a place or thing that you feel like you belong to, that you truly feel like you belong to. And then if you can make a contribution to that, that's it. That's all you need. You don't need anything else. And so I truly believe that. That's the definition of worth. If I feel like I'm contributing to something that I feel like I'm a part of and I'm passionate about, there's nothing else left to do. That's it. That's success. And so for me, it is then defining what community is. So if it's the community that I'm looking for and trying to figure out where I fit in, where I feel like I belong, then I've got to understand the units of community. And he talks about the smallest unit being two people, the biggest unit being the universe. And so my theory now is, and this is how I'm training the team, and this is how we will determine how much more we take on. If we start at the very bottom, the smallest unit of community, two people. For me, it's my wife, Adi. If I'm not contributing to that, I've got no business going on to the next largest unit of community. Till I've got that under control, I feel like I'm doing my best and contributing what I'm capable of contributing, then I'll move on to the next unit. And once I feel like I'm still happy and healthy and I'm still contributing to that, then I can move on to the next larger unit of community. And we're doing that as a restaurant. Because when we are happy and healthy, when we're taking care of ourselves, you're going to see that in the food. You're going to see that in the hospitality. And our guests are going to have a better experience, and we'll probably all live a little longer.
Yeah. What was it like for you? You mentioned going into rehab earlier and working through a lot of these issues and a lot of like physical health issues as well. Like at one point you were scared you might lose your eyesight. It was really, it's been a challenging few years for you. What was it like first going back into a restaurant?
It's the best way to describe it is there's a tornado happening. And you can either jump into the tornado or you can stay outside of the tornado and recognize that it's a tornado. Realize that you have the ability to create that distance and that you can control how far into the tornado you want to go, because that's what it feels like, because it's this hub of electricity. It's this hub of stress. It's this hub of a gazillion emotions, because you're working so quickly to feed your guests. And if you're a workaholic and a maniac, you're probably trying to execute things that aren't executable at that level. And so it's really paying attention to your nervous system. Mm. It's really paying attention to how your body feels and knowing when your nervous system is dysregulated. That's when you got to back off, because when your nervous system is that dysregulated, you go into the survival part of your brain.
Yeah.
You go into fight or flight. What happens there is you lose access to your prefrontal cortex where all rational decision-making occurs. So you just keep making more mistakes. And then you get pushed further and further into the amygdala part of your brain until you're not even yourself anymore. You're like outside of your body. Mm. You're running on neuropath. You're triggering neuropathways from your entire life and reacting based
on
those.
It's pure survival instinct.
Yes. So for me, I'm paying attention to that. Where am I at in my brain?
Yeah. This is going to sound like a joke, but I actually don't mean it as a joke. How would you describe being a dad relative to that?
It is the warmest feeling you could ever imagine. To look over and see like your face and your wife's face in that little child, whether they're screaming and yelling or whining or not. It's like, man, you realize that all of the things that you obsessed over and thought really mattered, they don't matter. Mm-hmm. Those things were distractions. Those things were coping. It helped me recenter and realize what was truly important. And I have to stay healthy and happy to be there for him.
Yeah. I love that.
And if you're doing your best, you're doing the best that you can with the tools that you have, that's all you can do.
Yeah.
Enter self-compassion.
We'll all work on that. Thanks, Sean. It was so great to talk with you today.
Oh, likewise, my friend.
Sean Brock is the author of the new cookbook, South, and the chef of the soon-to-be restaurant, Redbird, in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, we hope you enjoyed our visit with Sean, and if you want to try cooking some of his food, you can find his recipes for fried chicken and cornbread at splendidtable.org. And actually, I should probably tell you about my annual ritual with Sean, why I text him every January. So, in lots of parts of the South, the tradition is to eat collard greens and Hoppin' John on New Year's Day, because the greens symbolize money, and Hoppin' John, which is field peas and rice, is for good luck. And like so many other Southern foods, it's an African-American custom that's spread throughout the region. And anyway, one day, I was out shopping, and I happened upon a bag of dried beans, or peas, called Sea Island Red Peas. And I grabbed them right away, and I texted Sean about them, because I remembered hearing him talk about them, and how this incredibly delicious strain of peas was originally brought by enslaved Africans, and they were probably the original peas used in Hoppin' John. And he texted back, like, so happy that I'd found these things. It was like I told him I'd just gotten married, right? And he implored me to cook them out of his recipe from his first book, Heritage. So I go and open up the book, and I realize this recipe is so important to him. It's not even in the main part of the book, you know, where all the recipes are. He drops it right in the middle of the introductory essay to the book. And he was right. The recipe is phenomenal. And the key move, in addition to getting these great beans, is that you puree some of the beans with some of the cooking broth in the blender, and it makes this ridiculous gravy. And so I've been making that every New Year's Day for years now, and I text Sean afterwards because I'm thinking of him. And he was happy to know that the first year I did it with my own heirloom. The rice that year was from my family's hometown village in China. And that is our show for the week. You can actually find his recipe for Hoppin' John on our website too. We'll see you next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. Be sure to go to splendidtable.org to get information on anything you ever hear here. Look around at recipe collection, register for our weekly email newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and subscribe to our podcast. Our newest is a companion to that newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen with Melissa Clark. Melissa is the New York Times food columnist, award-winning author of a ton of cookbooks, and she has devoted her career to helping the home cook. In every episode, you get to hang out with Melissa in her kitchen as she walks us through one recipe designed to make your midweek eating delicious and a little easier. Subscribe at splendidtable.org or Apple Podcasts or wherever you do such things. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell and associate producer Erica Romero. Jenny J. Lou Lubke is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital producer, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.